Okay. So, Dion, so we have heard wonderful and very rich speeches in the last 2 days, and I think it's now time to conclude this symposium. And we have the honor to welcome two distinguished judges to carry out this difficult mission. I am indeed proud to announce that Brenda Hale and Suzanne Baer both agreed to conclude this conference. Let me very quickly introduce both speakers. Each of them comes from one of the two legal cultures studied in this symposium. Baroness Hale of Richmond is a justice of the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. She is the first and to this date only woman to have ever been appointed to the Supreme Court. And since June 2013, she is deputy president of the Supreme Court. Baroness Hale had also been president of the International Association of Women Judges in 2010-2012, and she's one of the greatest promoters of gender diversity on the bench within the common law and beyond. Suzanne Baer is a justice of the Federal Constitutional Court of Germany. She was appointed to the court in 2011 for a 12-year term. Suzanne Baer is also a distinguished legal scholar. She authored many books and articles on comparative law, human rights, equality, including gender equality, and sociology of law. She chooses to remain a professor of public law and gender studies during her 12-year term at the court. She teaches at the Humboldt University in Berlin and at the University of Michigan Law School. She also directs the Law and Society Institute in Berlin. I shall now give the floor to Brenda Hale first and then Suzanne Baer. Thank you.
I want to start with three congratulations. The first congratulations is to Adelaide Ramesh for organising this wonderful conference. The second are to the interpreters who have had a challenging time with so many fast-talking speakers. So I will try not to speak too quickly, but my apologies if I do. And most of all, congratulations to you surviving members of the audience who have lived through two very intensive days of discussion. And so I will try not to take too long. But I have to go back to the beginning, because yesterday Adelaide posited two hypotheses. The first, that the differences between the roles of the judges in the different types of jurisdiction, that is, the common law, the Romano-Germanic, and the international jurisdictions, and the judicial culture in those different jurisdictions, explains both why there are fewer women judges in common law jurisdictions and also why it has been seen as a problem in common law jurisdictions for longer than it has in, for example, this jurisdiction. But secondly, her hypothesis was that those differences in role and culture do not affect the arguments in favour of having women judges or the impact that women can have on the justice system. And she hoped that this conference would be a way of testing those hypotheses. Did you not? Well, I'm not sure that it has been, but I'll do my best to see where we might be. Firstly, on the role and culture of the judiciary, I found this a very interesting idea. Most judging is about finding the facts or presiding over a trial where a jury finds the facts, and then applying some well-settled law to those facts. But in a common law country, we accept that there is not always a readily applicable legal rule, or that such rules as there are not clear. And then the judge has two main roles. Firstly, if the subject matter is not covered by legislation, the role is to divine what the common law is. The theory is that it has always been that. What the judge does is unlock the door into Aladdin's cave and discovers the secrets of the common law within. This is and always was a fairy tale. The great strength of the common law is that it can, within limits, grow and develop to meet changing circumstances. We've done that recently in my court just the other week with a landmark decision. Secondly, however, if the subject is covered by legislation, our role is to divine what Parliament meant to achieve by passing it, even though we know perfectly well that Parliament didn't mean anything at all, because Parliament had never thought of the problem that presents us in court. Now, in both of those roles, it is accepted that the answer may be contentious. We are allowed, even expected, to disagree with one another. So the individual judge is very visible and very exposed. We each have to take individual responsibility for the decisions we reach. Often, therefore, we each of us feel the need to explain our decision in writing. We cannot leave it all to a juge rapporteur or even to the one whom we appoint to do the lead judgment, what I call the donkey work judgment. That is, as Adelaide explained, very different from the traditional role of the civilian judge. The theory is that the law is written and all the judge has to do is apply it to the facts. No creativity is involved. The judge can therefore be an invisible functionary. Now, I very much doubt that that is indeed how the civil law works. Certainly over the last 2 days, it hasn't sounded as if that's how the civil law works, and no doubt Susanna will tell me whether it does or it doesn't. I think Kelsenian constitutional courts can't possibly work in that way, because the whole idea is whether a written law is a valid law or not, and how that conforms to constitutional norms which may by themselves be very broad and very contentious and very open to different interpretations and applications. But I can see that the difference might lead to a different judicial culture, just as it leads to a different style of judgment writing. But I do think that Adelaide is right to say that this is one of the reasons why the lack of women judges has been seen as a problem in common law countries for a long time. Once we acknowledge that the judge has a role in shaping as well as applying the law, it is as problematic to exclude women from that role in the courts as it is to exclude them from that role in Parliament. As has often been said in this conference, it's not so much that our presence matters, but that our absence matters. Until recently, I wouldn't have accepted that this view of the judicial role is a reason why we have comparatively few women judges in common law countries, especially in the higher law-shaping posts. I would have said that this is almost entirely due to our different recruitment and appointments processes. We appoint our judges from amongst the most successful litigation practitioners. Until recently, we didn't think that anybody else was qualified to be a judge. And for all sorts of reasons, successful litigation practitioners are more likely to be men than women. In the United Kingdom, we have the special problem that the legal profession is still divided into barristers and solicitors, and that the top solicitors are usually transactional lawyers rather than litigators. And that, as Kate Mallison explained yesterday, it has been assumed that the only people qualified for the higher judicial posts are the top barristers. For all sorts of reasons, women are only now, this year, it's around 12% of top barristers. So they're actually doing quite well to have become around 17% of the higher judiciary. We are punching above our weight, one way of putting it. A long time ago, my pupil master told me that he didn't approve of women barristers because the bar is a fighting profession, and women not only should not fight, but were not any good at it. We were either too yielding or too obstinate. Back to the ideas of battles that were discussed earlier. I think those ideas are long gone. But I was shocked to hear recently a very top woman barrister say how much misogyny there still is at the English bar. So there are barriers there to appointment to the higher judiciary in particular, which are persisting and difficult to tackle. I have recently begun to wonder, however, a bit prompted by Adelaide's speculations, whether the role of the judges in shaping the law might be one of the reasons why the elite who currently occupy that role in my country are so keen to keep it to themselves. It is quite staggering that in the 10 years since I was appointed, there have been 13 vacancies on the court, and not one of them has gone to a woman. Now, how can that possibly be, other, of course, than that they've got one and they cannot bear the idea of having another? Of course, they don't put it that way. They put it as making sure that increasing diversity of all kinds on the bench does not dilute merit. Merit being defined, as we have heard, as the best man for the job. Now, I find it insulting that it should be assumed that diverse candidates will dilute merit. We should actually assume the reverse. I agree with Erica on that. However, I frankly doubt very much whether they are organised or thoughtful enough to see diversity as intruding into their law-shaping monopoly. I think it has much more to do with two more selfish concerns. Firstly, being afraid that if too many women and minorities are let into the higher judiciary, the salaries and pensions will become even more depressed than they have been recently. Now, don't forget that in the UK, we have far fewer judges than there are in the rest of continental Europe, and we are all paid a great deal more. You can get all this from the Eurostat. That is because we are mostly recruited from highly paid professionals, and the rewards must be enough to attract at least some of the best of them onto the bench. So that's their first fear. We're prepared to work for nothing, you know. Secondly, they're afraid that there will be fewer posts available for the traditional candidates. One of my brethren has been known to say that any form of affirmative action to improve diversity on the bench will instantly dilute its quality. Not because the diverse candidates will do so, but because the best men will no longer apply if they think they'll face more difficulty in being appointed than they have done in the past. Do you not find that astonishing? Welcome to the club, chaps. Women would never have got anywhere if they had been put off applying by the fear of being discriminated against, and men should not be put off now, and if they are, they shouldn't be judges. So, on the first hypothesis, I think it's an extremely interesting one that deserves a great deal more thought and research, but I don't think that we can find both parts of it demonstrated yet, and certainly not over the past couple of days. The second hypothesis was, however, that the arguments in favour of women on the bench are the same. And I think the last 2 days have completely demonstrated that she's quite right about that. The same arguments have come up time and time again in all kinds of jurisdictions, in all kinds of contexts. In her original paper, she identified 6 arguments, but I basically think they boil down to 4. And they're interconnected. They're not watertight. The first is legitimacy in the sense of public acceptability of and trust in judicial decisions. Once upon a time, it was thought to repose in a male presence. And in my country, of course, we still make most of the judges dress up in 18th century male wigs, just to emphasise that that is the model of an authority trust-inducing figure. But that view is not so acceptable anymore with a great many people. And a reference was made earlier today to the decline in deference towards traditional hierarchies and traditional professionals, which contributes to the view that legitimacy requires a broader judiciary than it did in the past. The second is symbolism, the embodiment of contemporary values of fairness and equal justice for all. As Judith Resnick pointed out yesterday, that is a late 20th century idea, equal justice for all, but now it permeates a great deal of our law. The third argument is one of efficiency, or equality of opportunity, to enable the best use to be made of the available legal talent, which, as all the studies show, is at the qualification stage, more female than male. And then fourthly, the argument is making a difference in the sense of bringing different perspectives to the business of judging, especially on issues of special concern to women, but not only on those. Now, it was clear over the past 2 days that the first three of those arguments, with various ramifications and extensions, have been deployed in many countries in support not only of greater diversity and specifically gender equality on the bench, but also in support of quotas and other kinds of affirmative action in leadership positions in other fields, as well as the law, in politics, in commerce and industry, and in academia. It was also clear over the past 2 days that it is the fourth argument, the making a difference argument, which is the most contentious. There is a sense in which all women's lives are different from all men's. We cannot escape the way in which others relate to us in our everyday lives from the day we are born. People inside and outside the family expect different things of us and react to us differently. There is nothing at all we can do about that. Men have exactly the same problem. It's just that the expectations and relationships are different. But of course, all women are not alike any more than all men are alike. We have different personalities, different backgrounds, different experiences, different values, different legal philosophies. So we cannot claim that there is a unique woman's point of view which has to be represented on the bench. What I think we can claim is that we are half the human race, or at least we ought to be. As our friend from India pointed out, there are places in the world where active steps are being taken to make sure that we are not half the human race. But we ought to fight against that as well. As half the human race, our experience, values, and philosophies should play an equal part with those of men in shaping and applying the law, even if a wise old woman will usually come to the same conclusion as her wise old man. Though I'm not sure my husband would always agree with that. So maybe I'm going to disagree with Adelaide again. It could be that this last argument has played a larger part in those jurisdictions where the law-shaping role of the judiciary is expressly acknowledged than it has in those jurisdictions where it is not. But I agree with Sally Kenny that even though it is an argument that we have made, and there's no reason why we should not make it, it is not an argument that is likely actually to find favour with those who might make a difference. It's the one I make and I get rejected, whereas when I come along with legitimacy and efficiency and symbolism, they all say, oh, yes, 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 of course, that's why we need more women judges. But the moment I start exploring the ways in which we are or may be different and the ways in which we might make a difference, they say, oh, no, that can't be done. So there is a political argument to be made, but there's a real argument to be made as well. Whether or not this is so, there is another aspect to this argument which has been brought out over the last 2 days, and I do think it's important, and that is the idea that impartiality flows from recognising one's own partiality. I have also had the annoying experiences described by Françoise Tulkens of men ignoring what I have said in search for support from other men who have said exactly what I have said, but they want to quote the men, they don't want to quote me. That happens a lot. But there is a way in which we do make a difference by our presence in the deliberations or in the judge's dining room, either by making it more difficult for them to voice sexist or indeed racist thoughts, or by having those thoughts voiced and challenged, or even if it's not overtly sexist or racist, pointing out that there could be a different point of view. A feminist perspective, if you like. However various that is. And so by our presence, we can contribute to the recognition that we all have our preconceptions and our biases and enable us to take them out and look them in the face. Me too. To me, whatever the arguments, it's not only a political and a philosophical question, it's an epistemological or even an existential one. In my everyday life as a judge, I just know that it's quite simply wrong and unjust that I am the only woman on the highest court in the United Kingdom. I'm very proud to have been appointed the first woman, but I am lonely, and I don't want to be the last. So I have to go on making a fuss about it, because if I don't, no one else on the bench will do so. And I can't retire until they've found at least one more woman to replace me. So I have to be here for a long time yet, judged by present standards. And that, I think, is a shame. So thank you for listening, and thank you.